It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the scoop on what you might want to catch out of this year's Sundance Film Festival.
But first, new numbers released today by the Department of Labor show strong gains in U.S. wages and job growth, even exceeding Wall Street expectations.
Job numbers grew over the past 11 months, and in revised data, last November stands out as a stellar month with 423,000 jobs created, the most since 2010. According to the report, workers are seeing more money in their wallets, too.
Is this a short-term uptick or the sign of a long-term economic recovery? Here to help us put these numbers in context is Brian Jacobson. He's Chief Portfolio Strategist at Wells Fargo Funds Management and Associate Professor at Wisconsin Lutheran College. Brian, thanks a lot for joining us. Brian, are you there? We'll try to bring Brian Jacobson up for our talk about the economy. Brian, can you hear me?
Okay, now I can hear you.
Yes, aha, okay.
You guys cut out on me there.
Oh, weird. We must hit a mute button or something. Anyhow.
I didn't say anything offensive yet. It was preemptive.
Well, we'll see. Not a lot of stuff to make us say bad words in this report, but a lot of times we see in the last year, 2 years, all right, here's some positive news. Here's the yeah, but downside. Is there a downside here that we're not seeing in the headlines?
Well, as an economist, I feel as though my job is to always point out the cloud behind every silver lining. So, there is some downside here. I do have to point out that wages still aren't growing as rapidly as what I think most people would like, especially if you're in one of those occupations in which wages just really aren't keeping up with inflation. Year on year for the entire labor force, wages went up about 2.2%. So that's a little bit above the pace of inflation, but it's still not to the point where we could actually declare, I think, victory over some of the recessionary forces that feel like they're kind of dragging on the overall economy. So this was a very good number. The last 3 months have been spectacular from payrolls gains, but there's still a lot of room for improvement.
So with staying with that wage thing, and this is something that people have been watching a long time saying, okay, yeah, we are adding 100, 200, 300,000 jobs a month. So why aren't the wages going up? Some people say this could be a first sign, but what do we know? Why are wages slow to recover even as job numbers go up?
Well, one of the reasons is because a person's compensation isn't just all wages. The cost of benefits has actually gone up a little bit faster than the cost of wages. So that's one of the contributing factors. So when you look at another measure, say the employment cost index, that's growing at a slightly faster pace than what just hourly wages are. So maybe just focusing so much on wages isn't giving us the whole picture of what it costs to employ a person. I think there's a lot of credence to that because people value the benefits that they're receive, and it's just not a matter of what you got on your pay stub. So that's part of it. But there's also a number of other forces at work that are keeping wages low. The fact is, there's still just a lot of people who are still part-time unemployed, or so they're part-time employed, but they'd rather be full-time employed. You still have a lot of people who are discouraged workers, so labor force participation rate is very low. So even though the headline unemployment number is looking good, it's 5.7%, so that's pretty decent, it still has a lot of room where it could go lower. So there's just not a lot of pressure right now to push those wages higher.
Now, with that workforce non-participation, the unemployment rate actually, I think, ticked up by 0.1% or something like that. So it looks like unemployment increased, but apparently that's because people are getting back into the workforce. The people who had given up, maybe discouraged is the usual word that applies, are more encouraged to get back on the job market.
That's right. And so there's always, when you see the unemployment rate change, it can change for a good reason or for a bad reason. In this case, the increase in the unemployment rate was actually for a good reason. It's because there are more people who are entering into the labor force. So perhaps they were actually outside of the labor force. They had just given up looking for work, and so they just threw in the towel. Now they're beginning to come back in. Hopefully that's a trend that will continue, although I have to be honest, it's a trend that I've been looking to change for the last couple of years. I thought that back in 2013, we were going to start seeing the labor force begin expanding a little bit more rapidly, which would then push the unemployment rate higher. But that didn't really happen much. So maybe it's early to say, but maybe with the decline in oil prices, increase in consumer confidence, continued high corporate profits, maybe people are getting a little bit more encouraged so that when they threw in the towel, they're beginning to kind of pick themselves back up and get back into the labor force.
Now, with the overall overall numbers, the big new job creation numbers from the last few months, from the last year, depending on which scale you look at. These are the best since 2009, in some cases the best since 1999, I guess, if you look at the year as a whole. What is driving that? Is this the sign of an economic recovery engine finally starting to turn over there?
It's starting to appear as though it's running on all four cylinders instead of just on three cylinders or even on two cylinders. So I think that it's a sign. The labor market is oftentimes viewed as being a lagging economic indicator, so it moves after the rest of the economy does. Typically, corporate profits expand first. So you see that showing up in like the GDP numbers. You see that sort of economic activity, and the labor market is a little bit sluggish in responding. And so I think it's just a matter of things are beginning to kind of begin firing on all cylinders for the U.S. economy. When you saw the GDP numbers for the second quarter and then the third quarter both being above 4%, fourth quarter came in at around 2.6%, so it was a little bit slower, but it's still a fairly decent pace, and it's actually at the point now where businesses, they're recognizing that, hey, if you want to expand, you might need to hire more people in order to do that. So that's why I think that we're beginning to see some of these better payroll numbers gains. Another thing, though, that's contributing to it is you have a lot of people who are working multiple jobs. One of the things that I noticed in the employment situation report was that as of January 2014, so looking back a year ago, about 4.7% of people who are employed were holding multiple jobs. Now that's up to 5%. So that's a slightly disturbing trend, and so I'm hoping that that doesn't get too much higher, because you don't necessarily want to have it where people feel as though in order to make ends meet that they have to be holding down more than one job.
A couple more points I wanted to touch on briefly. The sort of person who watches the economy is watching and waiting for the Federal Reserve to eventually increase interest rates. Talk they might do that in the fall. Now with these numbers, maybe sooner. What are you looking for there?
I'm looking for the Federal Reserve to probably increase interest rates at their September meeting. And that's not really an out-of-consensus call here or anything. I'm just looking at various financial contracts that are traded on what are called federal funds futures. And you can, from that, infer when the Fed might increase interest rates. And it seems to be kind of moving between either their June meeting or their September meeting. And honestly, for the economy, I'm not sure if it matters so much, because when they do begin raising rates, they're going to move it from right now to a range of 0 to 0.25% to probably 0.25% to 0.5%. So it's a very, very small change. I don't think that when the Fed begins raising rates, they're going to do it because they feel as though they need to slow down this economy or they need to get in front of inflation. I think it's because they recognize that by keeping interest rates as low as what they are, it's creating distortions. I mean, anytime you artificially lower prices or raise prices, it creates distortions. And I think the Fed kind of wants to get out of that a little bit, and that's why they refer to it not as tightening of monetary policy. They've been referring to it as normalization of monetary policy, because they recognize what they've been doing is very abnormal, but they don't want to move abruptly. They don't want to create too many waves, and so I think that's why they want to go slow and steady. And on February 24th, that's when Chair Yellen is going to be testifying before the Senate, delivering her semiannual report that she always does. At that meeting, she'll probably give a lot of explanation about what the Fed is thinking, about when they might raise rates, and about how quickly they'll raise rates.
And on the global stage, the story for a while has been, well, we've had a mediocre recovery, but that's pretty good compared to Europe and Japan, where the economy's not doing well. But is there a risk that what's happening over there, their tepid economies might hold us back in some way, or even pull us back down?
It is entirely possible, because the Federal Reserve has made mention of that in their latest policy statement, saying that they're monitoring international developments because they recognize that this is an globally integrated economy where what happens with our trading partners will affect us. And so we want to see Europe growing more rapidly. We want to see Asia growing more rapidly because it benefits us as well. I do see early indicators that the European economy especially is beginning to grow at a slightly faster pace. Once they get through some of this turmoil, the standoff between Greece and its creditors about the austerity and bailout programs, once they get through that, which I am confident that they will by the end of February, I think that we're going to see in the economic data coming out of Europe that they're beginning to grow at a slightly faster clip here.
Brian, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Brian Jacobson. He's Chief Portfolio Strategist at Wells Fargo Funds Management and Associate Professor at Wisconsin Lutheran College. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Right now, the movie business is swinging into high gear. Oscar season coming up fast, and the Sundance Film Festival ended last week, giving us a sneak peek at the next crop of independent films.
Our next guest was at Sundance last week, rubbing elbows with all the bigwigs in Park City, Utah, and screening a bunch of movies along the way. And he's with us now to tell us more about what he saw. Rob Thomas is features editor and movie critic at the Capital Times newspaper. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, in general, what was this year's festival like?
Well, I feel like the festival is really changing. I mean, I always thought of Sundance as this place, like you say, where these independent movies come. They're throwing a lot of love. And then, you know, they might go to the art houses or come out on DVD, but they don't make that much of a splash. And I think last year that changed. You had two films. You had Boyhood, which is a front runner now for Best Picture that premiered at Sundance, and also Whiplash, which is another Best Picture nominee, and probably J.K. Simmons is a lock for Best Supporting Actor. So all of a sudden, like, the movies coming at Sundance are getting bigger, it seems like. It seems like that's starting to become a launching pad for, like, some of the movies that will cross out of independent cinema and start playing in the multiplexes.
What does that mean about what independent cinema is doing right? Does it mean people are sick of the big budget studio films?
Well, part of it, I think, is a lot of studios now have their own independent sort of subsidiary. Like, there's Fox has Fox Searchlight, Universal has Focus. So, you know, they've learned that, like, they can sort of counter-program their own movies. They can have, like, a superhero movie and then play a better movie or, you know, a smarter movie in the other theater next door and make money both ways. But the other side of it is they can put a lot more promotion behind a movie than maybe a smaller distributor can.
So they can do it all right now.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing I think with Sundance movies is even the smaller movies, now you have Netflix and you have video on demand and stuff. I mean, a lot of these movies where it would have been harder to find them, you know, you're going to see them on Netflix in like 6 or 9 months. So it's a lot easier to see them. And I think a lot more people end up seeing them than they normally would.
So what everybody wants to know is, what are the big breakaway films this year? Was there a clear crop of frontrunners?
I don't know. There was definitely some that, you know, won the awards. And the big one was called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. And I think any good title is going to rhyme. So, but it was the big audience grand jury winner. It sold to, I think it was Fox Searchlight for like $12 million, which is a record for Sundance. The story of these two high school kids who befriend a girl who has cancer. It was described as sort of a, you know, update on The Fault in Our Stars, but even maybe better than that. So that's the one this year, I think, that a lot of people are looking at as like, that's going to be a big breakout hit.
And that was based on a book.
Is that right?
Yeah, from what I saw. And the reason I know this, well, let me back up. No one wants to play a clip from this film for you more than I do. I looked and looked, and the thing is that these films are so new that there's nothing out there. It's complete blackout. So there's nothing out there that I was able to find for this. But it sounds like it's going to be a fantastic movie.
Can you do a dramatic reading from the book, maybe? Or we can all play the different parts?
You know, there are. This is how much people want to see this movie. There are fake trailers up there with people just beating each other up in parks.
Is that
under
right?
Under the title, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Glad you didn't fall for it.
So this is a good movie. Another one that people wanted to see is a movie called Dope.
Yeah, it was another one. It was sold for like $7 million to Open Road. It also is probably one of the most buzzed about movies there. I didn't see it. It's a drama with African-American kids. I think it's set in the 90s or maybe the 80s, but it looks really interesting, has a great soundtrack and stuff. I saw a very short trailer for that online.
So did you see any Oscar contenders in this crop? You mentioned Whiplash and Boyhood as ones that do have some Oscar buzz around them. Did you see anything like that this year?
The one there's actually two I saw that I think at least have a real strong potential for, you know, best actor, actress. One would be The End of the Tour, which was the movie about the novelist David Foster Wallace, who wrote Infinite Jest. And it's set, it's based on a memoir by another writer, Rolling Stone writer, who went on a book tour with him for Infinite Jest right when it came out, right when he was starting to hit big. And Jason Segel, who's like from The Muppet Movie and How I Met Your Mother, plays David Foster Wallace. I thought it was going to be a disaster.
Yeah,
when I saw
I kind of think that too.
But he is great. I mean, he completely inhabits the guy you think David Foster Wallace is. But it's not a biopic, really. It's a movie about, you know, fame and the writing life. It's these great conversations between these two writers, one who's starting to get really famous, one who's maybe a little jealous of that. The other writer's played by Jesse Eisenberg. And I thought it was a great movie. I was really, it was by the guy who did Spectacular Now and Smash. So he's a James Ponsoldt, a really good director. And so that one I was really excited about. And I really think Jason Segel has a good chance of getting like a Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor nomination.
Did it feel respectful to you? Because that was one that people early on were worried about. It was too soon after he had committed suicide, and the estate, I guess, wasn't too happy about it. Did it feel like a loving homage or something that was respectful?
I would say, and the one thing I think is key is that it's not a biopic about his whole life. It focuses on basically 5 days in 1996, although it's framed by the news of his death. And it's him in, you know, a pretty good place. It'd be probably one of the high points of his life, and he's still kind of grappling with it. You know, I don't think it definitely doesn't wallow in, you know, his depression or anything else, but sort of talks about him dealing with it and trying to be better. So I think it's really, you know, about as good a job as they could have done.
Well, there are some movies that did actually have some audio out there. There's many of them.
Right.
And I do want to give us just a couple tastes of some movies that were at Sundance. This was a thriller. It's called True Story, and it's a James Franco movie. Let's take a listen.
Hello?
Hi, I'm a reporter with the Oregonian. I wanted to get your side on the Christian Longo story.
Who?
He murdered his entire family.
Why are you telling me this?
Because when they apprehended him, he said he was Mike Finkel of the New York Times.
Did he say anything at all about why he claimed to be me?
I hoped you might be able to tell me that.
He was just a regular guy, an intelligent, sane man. He comes home one night and kills his wife and gets it. It makes no sense.
Thank you for seeing me, Mr. Longo.
Call me Chris.
So why me?
I followed your whole career. I guess I felt like I knew you. I want to tell you my side of this. Only you. Maybe at this point it doesn't matter.
And that's James Franco is the creepy guy who mysteriously kills his family and blames it on this New York Times reporter. This one based on true events, apparently.
It sounds that way, yeah. James Franco had at least two movies at Sundance this year.
He's everywhere.
Yeah, so he had this one and then one called I Am Michael about a gay man who sort of embraces conversion therapy or something like that. I didn't see that one. But this True Story, I think, is coming out in April. So that's going to get a pretty wide release. And that was Jonah Hill was the New York Times reporter. So it's a pretty big cast.
And Rob, I was following your tweets from Sundance.
Oh, good.
Thinking lucky guy. Also noticing that you seem to be really in love with a movie called Brooklyn.
Yes. This is the other one I think probably has an actress nomination locked up for the actress whose name I should have. It's like Saoirse Ronan. She was in Atonement and Hannah. And this is her first lead performance. She's fantastic in this movie about an Irish young woman in like 1950s who comes to America as an immigrant, and about, you know, basically living in two worlds, having, you know, her old small town in Ireland and then living in Brooklyn and all the different things and getting used to that life here. The screenplay was by Nick Hornby, the novelist who did High Fidelity and wrote the screenplay for Wild. It's really a great movie. And and getting back to what I was saying before, like, it doesn't seem like a Sundance movie to me. It's like a period piece, historical drama, beautiful, sentimental, very romantic. But it's the kind of movie that Sundance is starting to get, I think, as people realize kind of what a big platform it can be.
Now, there's one that has a UW tie, I gather. It's called The Russian Woodpecker, or just Russian Woodpecker.
Right.
What do we know about that one?
I saw that one. That's really good. And I think that will be coming to the Wisconsin Film Festival here in Madison in April. It's a really interesting, strange movie from this UW graduate, Chad Gracia, who was not a filmmaker. He studied Russian, went to Kiev and was working on this theater project when he met this very odd performance artist who has this theory about Chernobyl, that it was deliberately set by the Russian government to cover up this even worse plot that was going on. It's really, which sounds very far-fetched, and he's a very weird guy, But the more you get into the movie and the more it sort of ties to what's going on right now in the Ukraine, it actually gets very powerful. So it won the World Cinema Prize for Documentary at the Sundance. So it's getting a lot of attention as well. It's a very strange movie, but it really pulls together in a strong way at the end. And I think people here can see it in April.
And any other favorites you want to tell us about?
Let me think. There was a very weird one that I liked a lot. Another one I was worried about called Last Days in the Desert, in which Ewan McGregor plays Jesus and the devil. And it's about...
What could go wrong?
Right. See? Yeah. And it's like he's like George Burns. He's like our George Burns. And it's Jesus wandering around in the desert waiting for a sign from God. And he meets his family. And it's really good. It's really...
Is it controversial? You're saying it's good, but is it anything there for people to get upset about?
You know, I don't think so. But, you know, who knows? It's definitely... I mean, I think it's definitely more... It's something for people of all faiths, I would say. It's a Christian film in theme, but I think there's a lot there for lots of different audiences. So, but interesting to see what people think about that when it starts hitting theaters.
Right. Well, I can't wait to actually see some of these, Rob. Thanks a lot. Did you meet any celebrities there before I let you go?
You meet all kinds of weird people. I was sitting next to one guy, and he was like, I was talking to him, and he said, "Oh, I run Showtimes." And I was like, "Oh, for a theater?" And he's like, "No, I run Showtime, the network."
Nice.
He was the president.
Well, Rob Thomas is features editor, movie critic at Capital Times newspaper. He's just back from the Sundance Film Festival.
I'm Rob Ferret.
Veronica Rickert, you're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, now that we've passed Groundhog Day, you could say we're in the dog days of winter. It's the time of the season when the snow and the cold are starting to get a little old, and we are starting to dream about the warm days ahead.
One of the things you might be getting sick of is the same old go-to soup recipes. So for this Food Friday, we decided to bring on an expert to make the most of our soups.
And we want to hear from you on this, too. What is your go-to soup recipe? What do you make for yourself when you can't stand the winter weather anymore and you want to be warm and nourished? And do you have a soup that you're famous for? Everyone knows that this is your soup. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our soup expert today is Chef Leah Kaplan, a food and branding consultant here in Wisconsin. Leah, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
So one of the things I look forward to, and I don't look forward to them all in winter, is soup. It's a great soup season. Is that you too?
Yes, although I actually love soup in the summer too.
You'll go soup year round.
Yeah, brothier soups in the summer, but yeah, 365.
So why do you think soup is, well, at least, you know, in winter, you like it all year round, but for me, I definitely make a lot more soup in winter. Why do you think it is that soup is so nourishing and perfect in winter?
Well, I think in the summer, we realize when we're getting dehydrated and we drink a lot of water. And in the winter, it's just dry. And so you don't really realize that you need that liquid. So it's a way of getting a meal and really getting a lot of extra liquid that you're not aware that you're in need of, which is why in a lot of cultures, soup for breakfast is a tradition to kind of rehydrate you.
So you think we're thirsty?
I think that's one component of it. I also think that winter soups, the way I make them, there's a lot more layering of flavors. It's a longer process. You get the aromas. There's something very therapeutic about making it. And actually, for once, it's a pleasure to stand over the hot stove for a long time.
All right, it's free bonus, so he takes a little pressure off the furnace or the boiler.
Yeah.
So are there universals? I know there's a zillion different things you can do with soup. Is there something that you'd say for any soup, it's got to have blank or you got to do that?
Well, there are some fundamentals that will give you sort of more flavor bang for the process. So... you can just put a bunch of stuff in water, turn on the heat, and then cross your fingers and hope that you get something flavorful at the end.
And sometimes I don't when I try that.
Yeah, and sometimes you do, depending on what those things are. But starting off and really cutting your onions very small, I often puree them in the food processor and then brown them. So I start them high, usually with olive oil. Get a lot of steam, which is the moisture evaporating from them, and then turn it down as they start to brown and let it cook long and slow. And that browning process really gives a meatiness and a substance to the soup that you can't get later in the process once you've added liquids to it. And then I might add some tomato paste or tomato to that and really cook that down until it's also brown and flavorful. And especially if you're making meatless soups, you know, meat's an easy way to get that flavor in. But to not have a thin tasting plant-based soup, you have to think about it and layer it. And then once you have that nice brown base, you can add water, you can add stock, you can add bones, you can add vegetables, whatever you want. And you can also, before you add your liquid, if you're going to add spices like curry or turmeric or chili, dried ginger, coriander, cumin, it's nice to add them to the sautéed onions and just release their oils into that a little bit before you add some liquid. Then there's the middle part of the soup, which is the liquid and all the other things. And then at the end, you have another opportunity to like really boost the flavor. So we've built the low notes of the flavor. And then at the end, depending on what the soup is, you can add vinegar, you can add lemon juice, you can add sherry, you can add citrus zest, fresh herbs, and all those things really brighten it up and liven it up. So you've got a really nicely balanced soup.
But those last flavors would cook, if I added the fresh herbs right at the beginning, it would what, cook out all the flavor?
Exactly, unless it was like rosemary or thyme. Sometimes you want to really cook those, but if it's fiend's herb, the light herbs like chives, parsley, dill, those you just want fresh at the end.
Well, you mentioned the browning of the onions and some tomato paste. I see a lot of sort of the trinity of soups, onions, carrots, and celery,
yep.
Which I think I finally learned after many years is another word for mirepoix.
Yes. Yes. Hey. So that's the French basic for soup, sauces, everything. And so when you think about the liquid content of those things and the sugar content, you have onions, which have a lot of liquid and a lot of sugar, carrots, which have a lot of sugar, and celery, which has a lot of liquid. So I still do the onions first, get them nice and brown. I also chop up the carrots super finely. I might put them in the food processor too. Once the onions are nice and brown, I add the carrots, get them super brown. And then the celery is never really going to brown in the same way, but by adding it last, you're not inhibiting the browning of the other products.
And then, and that's a lot of times, I think I learned both the word mirepoix and what it meant here on Central Time on a previous Food Friday, actually. And now when I'm making soup, I just make sure I always have those things. I'll start doing that and then figure out what soup I'm going to make. Because you can add just about anything to that combo, right?
Exactly. And the general proportion for mirepoix is 2 parts of onion to 1 part carrot, 1 part celery. I think we all have learned the mistake at one point or another, especially when making chicken soup, of putting too much carrot in, and you end up with this really sweet, sweet soup. But if you have lots of onion, you'll always outweigh that. And it's okay to throw some garlic in your mirepoix, too.
Oh, yeah. You have to have garlic in winter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you sent us a recipe for a cauliflower soup, and I think it uses some cashews, too. It's kind of a surprise soup. Cauliflower. I feel like cauliflower is the breakaway vegetable of the last year or so.
Yeah.
Because people discovered you can make sort of mashed potatoes with it and everything else. It's versatile. But what do you like about cauliflower and cauliflower soup?
This soup, this cashew cauliflower soup, is like the ultimate comfort food to me. It has, sometimes I put more curry in it or turmeric, but the thing about this is it's a really rich, creamy soup, but there's no dairy in it. You essentially make a cashew milk by combining cashews and vegetable stock, pureeing that in a blender. And it's just amazing, the smooth, creamy richness that it gives. And it doesn't taste, you know, it doesn't taste like cashew butter or something dense like that. It's just this back note of toasted cashews. And the cashews and cauliflower are just a really harmonious combination, I think.
Do you soak them first?
Just toast them, because anytime you're making a nut milk where you really want to taste that nut as opposed to having it be a background to something, toasting the nut brings out the flavor. So they're not soaked in water. They're just pureed in the stock, and then you cook the whole thing together and strain it at the end.
So with cauliflower, is that a veggie you want to saute first, or does it just boil or simmer in the broth?
In this case, it doesn't need to saute. Mm-hmm. You could. Typically, I just don't with cauliflower. I have my onions and those things in up front to get my browning. And then with the cauliflower, I just want to get it cooked and nice and tender and let the flavor, if you saute, you know, you're losing some aromatics into the air. But by steaming or sweating, all of those are condensing and going back into the pot.
So walk us through this one a little bit more. How does it come together?
You start with onions and hing or asafoetida, which you can skip if you don't have it. It's an Indian spice, and it smells almost like gasoline or lilies.
You're really selling us.
Wait, gasoline or lilies?
Which smell the same to me. And I love the smell of
you're
both.
You're a chef. Interesting.
And you put it in just in really a very small amount, and it just adds a nice back note to it. But you sweat your onions and cauliflower and then puree the cashews with the vegetable stock and add that liquid and also either potato or sweet potato and cook all that until the potatoes and cauliflower are super tender. And then puree it all. I always prefer to puree soups in a blender rather than a food processor. A food processor just isn't good for liquids, and it gets much smoother and almost whipped in the blender. Or you can use an immersion blender, of course. And then, matter of personal preference, you can strain it through a strainer or through cheesecloth or not if you don't mind it a little rustico.
That recipe is available at the Central Time Facebook page for cauliflower soup. We're talking to Chef Leah Kaplan. She is sharing some great soup-making advice for the winter months.
And we're taking your calls now. What questions do you have about making the perfect soup? And if you've got a recipe to share, one that you can share with the rest of us to give us some fresh inspiration here in February, let us know. What is your favorite soup to make in the middle of winter? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our Food Friday discussion right now about soup with Chef Leah Kaplan. She's a food and branding consultant.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What is the soup that gets you through winter, either when you make it or somebody else makes it for you? What is your secret? What's your tip for making great soup? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on our Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to the calls right now. We've got Mike joining us in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi. So my favorite, I love soup. Let's start by, I love and live, can just live off of soups. Now, my favorite is just a basic ham and potato soup. And it's great for like the Christmas hams, holidays, and so forth, because you get a meal and the leftovers and you get to make soup. So what I do is I take a basic large ham, bone-in ham, and cook it. Like you cook a standard ham, throw it in a turkey pan or a large pot, large enough to where I take the turkey. I mean, sorry, then turkey pan. Take the ham, drop that in there. Throw in two large yellow onions, about 2 pounds of potatoes. I use the Yukon Gold, and I add a can of chicken broth, a low sodium chicken broth, and then I. Cook the ham just like I would cook a regular ham. I also put a little bit of honey on the ham, and I cook that ham till the ham is done, and then I separate out all the veggies, pull the ham out, debone the ham, take about 2 pounds of ham off the ham and the bones, set that off aside for the soup stock, and then I take all the vegetables that were in the pan, the potatoes and the onions, so that's basically it, and then I puree all the juice along with the potatoes and the onions, and it usually fills up about it's usually about enough by the off cooking of all the fat and juices from the ham. Usually the grand total is pretty close to about a quart and a half. Two-quart saucepan will be full from that.
All right. Thank you so much, Mike. Whoa, serious ham and potato soup. All the roasting and the deboning of the ham. It sounds delicious, Mike. What do you think? Is he doing it right, Leah? You got any advice?
Yeah, it sounds delicious. And a few things that brings up is there are great ways to get salt and flavor into soup without adding salt. So even though ham and bacon are salted meats, those are great because you're getting the salt and you're getting another flavor. Adding fish sauce, adding a Parmesan cheese rind. I use anchovies a lot in my bean soups. Those are all just nice ways to accent soup, and it doesn't have to taste like fish or fish sauce. You want to just put them in as a light seasoning.
Do you puree them or something first? You don't want to just have an anchovy floating
around,
right?
Well, they fall apart.
They just disintegrate in soup.
Yep.
Mommy, there's a fish in my soup.
My bean soup. And then a couple other things that are good to keep in mind with soup is the larger the quantity, the better the flavor. So if you make 2 cups of soup, it just everything cooks so fast that you're not going to get the same flavor extraction as if you're making 2 quarts or more. So when I make soups, I usually make as much as I can fit in a pot and then freeze them and sort of freeze them in individual servings so I have a nice variety. And then the other thing is most soups really benefit from sitting overnight. The flavors just extract that much more.
Who can wait that long, though?
Well, that if you make a big enough pot, you
can have some now, some later. Gotcha. I see where you're going.
Mike, thanks a lot. We'll all be by after the show today for some ham and potato soup. We've got Michelle on the line now in Platteville. Michelle, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your soup?
Well, I don't have a soup to share, but I was wondering if your guest had any tips on making a beer cheese soup, because I've tried to make it a couple of different times, and it just doesn't turn out very tasty. It's kind of a little bitter sometimes, or a little too tangy. So just wondering if she's got a recipe or some tips to share.
So is it too tangy, like beer tangy or like cheese tangy?
Like, I don't know. Like I said, or more kind of a bitter, I guess. So I don't know if it's coming from the beer. I've tried like a Blue Moon Ale in there, and I've also tried Guinness, and I've also tried, because I've only made it like 2 or 3 times, and I think I just tried like a cheap beer too, like, I don't know, Budweiser or something like that. So
My guess is it's the beer, so I would probably keep experimenting. If you maybe did a porter or something that's like a smoother, richer flavor, that might help. Do you put mustard or mustard powder in it?
I don't think that I did. It's probably been a couple of years since I've made it.
Yeah.
So. Like I said, I've never really had any success with it. And then I was listening to the program and I thought, oh, maybe she has a good recipe that I could try because.
I would definitely try it with a porter.
All right. Good luck. I hope that helps. And let us know how it turns out. Just send us a message at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go next to Laura. Laura's joining us in Oshkosh. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I'm calling about a wild rice soup recipe that I actually got in Minneapolis at Byerly's grocery store, and I bought the cookbook eventually, and it's the perfect wild rice soup. I took it to work last week in a crock pot, and my co-worker's husband is a chef, and she said it's better than any soup he's ever made.
Wow.
And, so it's right out of the grocery store recipe book, but it's, you know, it's got to be the Minnesota wild rice. Of course you do, just like you had said with the onions and the carrots and the celery, sautéing them first. When you add the flour to thicken it up with some broth, I don't do the water. I always do some sort of a vegetable broth. And then once you've got that kind of thick, what do you call that, a roux?
Yes. Well, roux is like, okay. When you do flour, well, roux is when you cook flour with a fat, like with butter or oil, and then that.
You do need to add the butter, yeah. Thank you for that, because you have to get the fat in there. So you get it kind of thick, and then you start gradually adding your broth.
Yep.
And then the flour, you know, it doesn't, like, what, coagulate or get lumpy or anything. It's real smooth. And then you add your rice that's been cooked, right? And it over time, it will keep soaking up that broth.
Sure.
And then you start adding in the cream. But like you said, I put mine in the refrigerator or freezer for a couple days.
Wow. Laura, thanks a lot for that call. Leah, apart from obviously replacing Minnesota wild rice with Wisconsin wild rice, any other ways to improve on a wild rice soup?
Well, I like the idea of doing it with a roux. And I think I like to also add brown rice and mushrooms, and I finish it with a little dry sherry.
What does the sherry do? Just give it a little bite or something?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And there's something about sherry in soups. You know, turtle soup is traditionally served with a little shot of sherry that you add to it. So it's not as much of a bite as vinegar, but it's, you know, a lot of alcohols, you want to evaporate the alcohol when you're putting them in soup, but sherry is an exception to that. You want to add it at the end and you get the aroma of the alcohol and the flavor, and it's delicious.
And just briefly, Leah, we're getting short of time. Any other favorite additions to soup?
I love adding barley, and I didn't label my grains recently and accidentally added steel-cut oats instead of barley, and it was great.
Oh, really?
But you had to cook it about twice as long.
Wow.
And like the wild rice, those things will just keep absorbing liquid, so you want to go very conservatively with them. For about 8 cups of liquid, a half a cup of steel-cut oats or barley will thicken it quite well and be very substantial.
Well, Leah, thanks. A lot of great tips, and it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
That's Chef Leah Kaplan, food and branding consultant, with us on Food Friday to talk about how to get the most out of our winter soup making. It's been a week of weird animal stories here in Wisconsin. Back on Monday, you might remember Groundhog's Day, we talked about the mayor of Sun Prairie who was bit on the ear by Jimmy the Groundhog. That's the local weather-predicting version of Punxsutawney Phil.
And if that's not enough for you, a story from further along Highway 151 has also gone viral. It happened last week, just hit the news yesterday. Police were called to a McDonald's in Beaver Dam after a customer called to complain about a woman who had brought her kangaroo to the restaurant. The woman says a kangaroo is a therapy animal, but police did ask her to leave the restaurant. They said there were some safety concerns there. Beaver Dam police described this as what they called an unusual call.
Yeah, it doesn't come up every day. Now, I see a pattern emerging. Sun Prairie, then Beaver Dam. By my calculations, looking at the map in 151, the next strange Wisconsin animal story should take place in Fond du Lac. So our Fond du Lac listeners, take all necessary precautions. Let us know if you've got any unusual sightings there.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb, and I'm going to predict this will be, the next one will be a wombat invasion at a PDQ.
At a PDQ
in Fond du Lac.
I thought you were going to go for a Fond du Lac ferret, maybe, get the alliteration and my last name in there. Well, we'll be watching for that over the next week. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.